Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 339 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. Getting closer to getting the air conditioning fixed.
Did you fix the gouge on the side of your house from the guy falling off the ladder?
Not yet, but I eventually will after I get AC running again.
can you briefly tell me the story about the guy falling off the ladder?
It was last Saturday. You remember when we had the rain and snow, and I had scheduled the appointment, and then I decided that it was probably a good idea that he not come. And I called his company, and I said, you know, you guys really want to come today still because it's raining and it's ugly and it's cold and they're predicting snow. Oh, yeah, we work in that. And I said, well, yeah, I know you do, but it's just not a critical situation. I don't need air conditioning when it's 32 degrees outside. And they insisted on coming. And then after they diagnosed the parts they needed, but he came back, he climbed the ladder, and he said the ladder broke and he fell, and he broke his foot. But I'm not sure if the ladder broke or it wasn't properly secured. That'll never be known.
And you ended up with two little track marks at the bottom of your house from where the thing crashed into your house?
I did, and shoe marks and everything else, but it's relatively benign. You know, a little bit of paint and sanding will fix it, and I'm not going to make an issue of it if they don't make an issue about him falling.
Remember to show your support for the show by hitting like and subscribe and leave 5-star reviews, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can do those thumbs up thing. Larry, there's this podcast, a YouTube channel that I watch where the guy, he like calls off to somebody off screen and he's like, we're going to get so many likes. And he's like, you know what? So we're going to do another one if we get this many likes, and I'll probably do it anyway because I don't have a life otherwise. I'm not going to go through all that, but you could press like also. And then, of course, we got a new patron this week, so you could head over to patreon.com/registrymatters and become a supporter, which would be incredibly valued. And we would thank you from the bottoms of our hearts. Tell us what we're doing this week, Larry, please.
Well, we're not doing anything because I couldn't have enough time to prepare, so we're going to shut down.
Okay. Adios.
So, no, we have a fairly significant win for PFRs from the 11th Circuit. And we have one article, if time permits, and a couple submissions, one from Douglas and another one from Robert. And I'm really afraid to do Robert's, but it does have some good points in it other than the political angle that I'm not too fond of.
Well, let's go right into this. So all of you Trump supporters, maybe fast forward 5 minutes, or this isn't us saying it, just repeating what this guy said. I'm afraid of the things that have been going on since Trump was reelected. Fear that this means that things are going to get drastically worse for those with PFR-type crimes. Trump has been fairly open about his desire to become a fascist dictator. He has said that he desires to be a dictator on day one in an interview. I think he said he would only be a dictator for one day, something more along those lines. And that he thought he had some good ideas and wanted his generals, and that he was looking to extend his team. I fear that he is serious about this and is going to try and seize power for himself like Hitler did. The economic uncertainty that he has been causing could be deliberate in order to trigger mass protests, at which point he could declare an emergency or impose martial law to set himself up as the dictator he wants to be. If he becomes the dictator, it is easy to argue that he will start setting up death camps like Hitler did. To justify these camps, he could justify them as a place to start by sending PFRs. With the prejudices that society has for those who have to register, society will most likely look the other way about them. This would open the door for them to slowly turn into a place to fix society by kicking off what they see as illegitimate members of society. This would make life much harder, if not dangerous, for people on the registry already. I'm seeing hints that society has already started moving in that direction. I would like your thoughts.
Wow. I've discontinued predicting what Trump might do, because my predictions have been grossly less than what he's done. So my predictions have been inaccurate, so I can't predict what he might do. But the point that I do agree with is that PFRs would be a target vulnerable population that would allow for his prejudices, if he has those prejudices. Remember, I said if, for him to do those types of things to PFRs.
My own personal argument would be is that he doesn't necessarily have those prejudices, but it would be an easy win to set them up. And considering that there are basically no supporters, there wouldn't be anybody, what's the word, opposing to round up the PFRs and put them someplace. That, like you just described, that would be an easy sell to take these undesirables and put them in this place because of the safety of society.
Well, the writer didn't make it clear that he's talking about people that are merely on the registry that have been punished and completed their punishment, or if he's referring to people that are under supervision, because it would be fairly easy to find violations of supervision if your goal is to get those kind of despicable individuals off the streets. So
Right.
that would be achievable, but what would be the basis for him locking up PFRs? Let's just say hypothetically that the administration wants to try that. What would be the elite lawful authority to go out and put the handcuffs on people? How would they do that?
We have to back out of that because this would then get into hyper-partisan kind of ideology, and we should stay away from, like, what would be the rationale? Like, we have sent people that have legitimate reasons to be in the country. We have sent them to other nations. So I don't think you need to really stretch out and go, what would be the rationale?
No, I didn't say
Because
what would
they're
be the rational.
undesirable.
Not sure. Now, what would be the lawful authority to take a person who's not incarcerated, who's merely obligated to register? The people that he was that were shipped out of the country, they were already in a custodial setting, correct?
But they arrived in a custodial setting based on other factors that they, and they still had the right to be here.
Right, but if they were already in a custodial setting, I'm trying to figure out how he would create a custodial setting for the people who
Just
are merely
fear-mongering.
registered. I don't know how he would lawfully round those people up.
I would still make the argument, though, that given even that barrier, he would say, "Stop me." And it would go to court, and then the courts would be the ones that would have to say, don't do it, and then they would have to comply with the court order.
If they chose to.
Right, exactly. That would be the next step. And I don't think you're going to find a bunch of people picketing outside of wherever they're rounded up to. You're not going to find that many people with signs saying, let the PFRs out.
But then we'd have to imagine that a chief executive of the United States who put his hand on the Bible, and they literally do put their hand on the Bible when they're swearing into the presidency, we would have to assume that he would disregard everything about constitutional authority and about having to have some basis to detain a person and round them up and do something like that and just ignore everything about the Constitution. I'm not ready to say that I think he would do that, but I suppose this writer was.
He went on to say there have been laws that are moving through the Oklahoma legislature that are concerning. One is a law that would make any PFR, including a child, require the person to receive chemical castration as a requirement to be considered for parole. The second would add the death penalty as a possible sentence for crimes involving children. These two laws tell me that society is willing to allow these thoughts to proceed. It is easy to believe that the first could start creeping closer to allowing us to be sent to special camps. And then if we start dying, they would look the other way. And I want to make clear that Oklahoma is not the United States. It is part of, and they can make their own laws, and that has nothing to do with Trump.
Well, I appreciate you making that point. Now, Oklahoma is one of the states that just is resoundingly in favor of Trump.
Very true.
I think he got like 72% or something of the vote of Oklahoma, so it was like almost three-fourths of the vote. But the people in Oklahoma, among other states in this country, are proposing and enacting such laws. So that is directly a reflection of where the people are. If they're willing to castrate and execute PFRs, that kind of tells you what your population's like. Now, we have beat those proposals back several times in a row here. they don't even get on the first committee. But that's a bunch of damn liberal do-good pointy heads. I don't know what you would do in Oklahoma because you don't have a bunch of damn liberal do-good pointy heads in the legislature.
I lived in Oklahoma for a period of time. It was probably only Oklahoma City, possibly even Tulsa, that would have had any support for not Trump.
Well, and I agree that these proposals are very dangerous. And if they get introduced in most of the Bible Belt, they're going to pass.
Yeah. And I believe, I don't have all 50 states like an example of, but that is one of the states where your license is marked very, very, very conspicuously about your PFR status.
I believe you're correct. I believe there's litigation on the drawing boards for that, but I believe Oklahoma does mark the license in a not too discreet manner.
And isn't, I don't know of another one that is that bad, but wasn't there a case 3-something years ago, maybe, that we covered where they tried to beat it back and they just miserably failed?
Tried to beat what back?
The marking on the license plate in Oklahoma.
Yes, there was. Absolutely. I remember that case. Yeah, there was a challenge that failed, and there was another one underway.
Very well. Well, moving on to from Douglas, he stated, when we conversed last, I told you about my parole restrictions, and you wondered if these restrictions were applied to all PFRs. I'm here to tell you I have the MDOC PFR policy clearly stating anyone who has committed a PFR type offense is under a blanket policy of no social networking. While again, I won't go into detail, I'm sure you can see this policy, as it is written, is very open to interpretation and hard to understand. Organizations that I intend on being part of support my system, and I spoke to the parole board about it, and were deemed social networking by my normal parole officer. This almost landed me back in prison. There is more of this, how PFRs are being treated during their parole, and something needs to be done. My last day of parole is July 7th, 2025. Well, congratulations, you're just about 2-ish or so months away, which is also when I will begin opening my mouth really wide, spitting out all of our stories. Now, would you advise that, Larry?
Let me answer first. The MDOC is talking about Michigan. This writer is in Michigan, so we're not talking about Missouri or any other state. I should have put that in there. I would be careful on advising that course of action because he'll still be subject to registration, which places him in danger, albeit less danger than if he were under direct supervision for his offense. But the registry carries penalties for noncompliance, and a determined investigation might yield a noncompliance on something very minor and technical. So I would be very careful just how wide you open your mouth. I'm not saying hide. There's somewhere in between those two things, like donating money, writing and researching. There's some things that you could do that put you in less jeopardy, but just going on a rampage might, unless you can walk the walk and never do anything wrong, never be in a zone of danger on compliance, be careful what you do with these people because they will retaliate.
He could watch the legislature, Larry.
He could definitely do that. He could write after watching it, he could watch the committee hearings. He could write summaries of what they were talking about. He could write scripts for people who can go in person, you know, bullet points. He could do a lot of things.
He could write emails.
Yeah, those are not very effective.
Sorry, I just had to throw those out. I was being obnoxious. All right. And then he stated, the last issue I need to bring up concerns future employment. Now, the doctors are telling me physical labor is out for me due to all of the problems with my spine, and I have future surgeries that I'm planning for. That leaves out most avenues for employment as a PFR. Additionally, I can't and don't drive. Impossible for me at the moment. And I'm experiencing some mental health issues that keep me away from most environments outside of my house. But I want to start planning for gainful employment, and I wonder if my plan might be doable. I am beginning to learn how to code on computers and through a college education and beginning to train as a customer support person to possibly earn some money while learning to code. These jobs are in demand, are remote, and I can do them from the remote comfort of my house, where my mind is most at ease. What I wonder is, do you think I can earn some money and become a functioning member of society proceeding with this plan? Can a determined PFR like me survive and earn a living in a career path like this?
Well, part of that is a little bit over my head about coding and stuff that he's talking about. But since he's going to be off supervision, he won't have very many restrictions at all, because being in Michigan, that was one of the things that has been troubling from a constitutional perspective for the registrants. So I think he'll have very minimal, if any, employment prohibitions after, what did he say, July, whatever day it was?
Yeah, just a couple months away. And, that's 3 months away.
So, but in terms of the stuff he's talking about that's over my head, you're probably better situated to answer that.
I can't, and I'm going to just tell you right now that on our Discord server, so you can find those links in the show notes, here tonight now, there are two people in chat with us that are professional coders, if, you know, for lack of a better term. They are computer people by that. And I know of a handful of others that, as their profession, as a PFR, some on supervision, some only on the registry, they are gainfully employed. I was gainfully employed as a computer programmer the second I walked out of prison. Granted, my situation is a little bit on the extreme, on the outside of the normal bell curve, but you can totally do it. You can find, there's even Illinois Voices, the guy Will there, they have remote support jobs where you're like phoning for political campaigns, you're doing like telemarketing stuff. That's all at home, and they don't pay great, but it's pay, and it's a job. And you could check them out at Illinois Voices. I'd have to come up with a better link than just that, but that's where you're going to try to go if you wanted to find some kind of job where you're on a telephone and you need a computer and you need internet, and you have to be able to type reasonably well and communicate fairly well, and you know, something along those lines. I'm personally, Larry, I'm personally in college to become a software engineer, even though it's what I do by day. I'm trying to flesh out my skill set and have a more broad spectrum of what I know how to do in case I need to go find employment elsewhere. And honestly, part of it is to help Narsal, that they need a developer, and it costs a lot of money and seems to be hard to track someone down. And I'm trying to do it so that I could be more useful in that space as well. So I would encourage you to join in on the Discord server that we have, and you could talk to a couple guys and more. And there's jobs all over the place for IT people. They may not be remote, but that's at least something that is available for IT people. Somehow, Larry, managers still want to put their thumbs on employees and make sure that they're coming to work every day.
Imagine that, paying somebody and wanting to have accountability. That's crazy talk.
I know, right? Oh, and Mike in Michigan says the same thing. He is also an IT person. And hey, this guy's in Michigan as well, right? MDOC?
Yep.
So there are three people here listening to us record this live. And I think the guy in Arkansas, he is also IT tangentially related. So it is highly doable.
All right.
Shall we move along?
Let's do it. I think we're at the main event, aren't we?
We are. All right. You have this silly case that you want us to analyze from the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. It originated in Alabama. It's a win for PFRs. Before we get in the case, what is your general opinion of this case?
Run by the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
I misspoke. That was your opinion of Alabama. Sorry.
The government of Alabama, not Alabama. There's a lot of great people in Alabama, but they're overwhelmed by craziness in their government.
Sorry. I was trying to read and find the right button while I moved around. All right. So Alabama, the government of Alabama is run by a bunch of crazy Looney Tunes.
I would stand by that. If anybody can show me evidence to the contrary, please do so. They gas people with all sorts of heinous methods.
Oh, yeah.
They have some of the most poorly run prisons in the country. It's been hammered by the courts over the decades for that. They're horrible with their educational system. Of course, they do well in football. They do pretty well with Alabama and Auburn football, but it's a miserable place. I wouldn't want to live.
And to be honest with you, Larry, sometimes I disagree with your analysis, but in this instance, I'm not sure that I do that much. Now, let me set up the case. The name is Bruce Henry versus the Sheriff of Tuscaloosa County, Alabama. In his official capacity, the District Attorney of Tuscaloosa County, Alabama, in his official capacity, and the Attorney General of the State of Alabama in his official capacity. What was the issue here?
Well, it has to do with the Alabama PFR code, 15-20A-11, subsection D4, which prohibits adult PFRs who have been convicted of a PFR type offense involving a child from residing or conducting an overnight visit with a minor, including their own child. No exceptions. And the plaintiff named Bruce Henry pled guilty to one count of possessing child porn in 2013, challenged that section on a facial basis and as applied to him.
He filed this like 12 years ago? Hold on, really?
No. That's when he was convicted of his child porn.
Oh, okay. All right. So otherwise, how long has this case been underway?
It's been underway for 3.5-4 years since November of 2021. Henry sued in November 2021, and he claimed that section violates the First Amendment right to intimate association and the 14th Amendment rights to equal protection and due process. He sought a declaratory judgment. Now, listen, folks, declaratory judgment, that is the correct thing to do. That section 15-20A-11-D4 is overbroad and unconstitutional, both facially and as applied to him. And he requested that the district court enter an injunction against the defendants to prevent the law's enforcement.
And was the injunction granted?
No.
Was Mr. Henry a good plaintiff, in your opinion?
Not especially. Henry had pled guilty in 2013 to one count of possession of child porn in the United States Federal Code section. He had never been convicted of any PFR type offenses before. At the time of his arrest in 2011, he possessed 2 videos and 348 photos of prepubescent and adolescent girls, which he downloaded from the internet. Henry's collection focused on girls between the ages of 6 and 10 and included depictions of, can we say that on a family program?
Let's not. Just say S&M.
S&M. And what's the other thing that deals with animal abuse?
That would be the one where animals are involved. All right. Well, that sounds like less than an ideal for a challenger to be.
Indeed, it does. The district court, when he pled guilty, sentenced Henry to 70 months in prison. Now, remember, 6 times 12 is what, 72. So it's almost 6 years. And 60 months of supervised release with appropriate special conditions. He served 5 years of his sentence because he gets that 15% off. And he was released in March of 2018. And after his release, Henry completed a qualified PFR treatment program as well as individual group counseling. Now, listen, folks, this is going to come up again later. So he was in PFR treatment as well as group counseling. Henry continues to this very day to attend weekly Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings, and he maintains a steady job, attends church, and he volunteers.
And as I was reading all 111 pages of this opinion, I noticed that Henry has violated his supervised release, which I gotta think that doesn't bode well for you in any kind of challenge of saying that you've been rehabilitated. But that's just my thoughts.
That's correct. So you had to go through a lot of pages to find that. But while on supervised release, Henry in 2 instances accessed illegal porn. In July 2019, Henry admitted during a polygraph interview that he had used Amazon Fire Stick to view porn. Now, what is Fire Stick?
It is similar. Do you know what a Roku is? If you don't know what a Roku is, then I'm kind of lost. It's a little stick that you can put into your television and watch Amazon or Netflix or other streaming services. So Amazon has one. They're like $20. It's a great way to get online to watch television.
Okay, so he admitted during a polygraph interview, and then a forensic examination revealed that he had saved no images, but he had viewed the images with titles indicating that they were young or teenage females. And Henry admitted in a follow-up polygraph test that he actually sought out images of teen girls and children posed in sexual positions. Can you finally admit that the kabuki machine works?
He admitted to it, so that's not like they detected anything. So no, I am not going to agree that it works. It scared him, as we, I will agree it scares people into confessing. So yes, no, yes and no. That's my answer.
Well, but it did work. And
it got him to admit to doing things.
In December 2019, he also admitted, now remember this, there seems to be a pattern with him. He admitted that he had used his wife's unlocked phone to search for images. He disclosed the incident to his treatment provider, but failed to inform his probation officer during the officer's visit to his home in January 2020. Now imagine that. Okay, you would tell your treatment provider and not your PL. Well, let's see. If you're getting treatment, theoretically, they're trying to help you. If you're on supervision, chances are they're not. But instead, the probation officer learned about the incident from Henry's supervision report that month. That's the reason I refer to PFR treatment as a collaborative fishing expedition.
And don't forget that when you start treatment, you sign whatever the HIPAA form would be, that they are allowed to share the information with your handlers.
Yes.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, let's move on then. The opinion states Henry has completed his term of imprisonment, married and fathered a son. But in section 15-20A-11D4 doesn't allow Henry to live with his son. So he can pop the kid out or, you know, do the things that make the kid pop out, but he can't live with him. Henry asserted that in section 15-20A, et cetera, violates his First Amendment right of intimate association and the 14th Amendment's guarantees of equal protection of the laws and due process of the law. In particular, he argued that section 15-20A-11D, etc., interfere with perhaps the oldest of fundamental liberty interests that the 14th Amendment secures, which is the fundamental right of parents to make decisions concerning the care, custody, and control of their children. He cited Meyer versus Nebraska, 262 U.S. Code 390-something or another, from 1923. That's a precedent dating back more than 100 years. Now, this case sounds familiar to a similar law enacted in Tennessee, also a very southern state.
Very similar. In fact, I think they enacted this, they claimed in response to Tennessee was doing it, so if Tennessee's doing it, so could they, because they don't want their PFRs from Tennessee moving to Alabama.
Right, so it's a game of lowest common denominator, who can be the inshittification of the situation for PFRs. If they make it worse, we'll make it worse, and then they'll make it worse, and it's just this whole circle jerk running around making things worser. Now, I have heard you pontificate for years that they can pose almost any prohibition on PFRs if they narrowly tailor it. Now, did they do that in this?
I'm thinking not. According to the court, Alabama has not narrowly tailored its law to achieve its goal. The law offers no escape hatch whatsoever. So a person who's been convicted of a qualifying PFR offense has no chance to avoid the law's prohibition by proving that they wouldn't be dangerous to their child. Rather, in every case without fail, Alabama law prohibits PFRs who've been convicted of a qualifying offense from residing with their child, even if the individual can prove that they present no risk to their child.
Now, I saw that. And they also said, as a result, it deprives some individuals convicted of qualifying offenses of their fundamental right to establish a home and bring up their own children in violation of the 14th Amendment. And it deprives some children in Alabama of the presence of a parent who may be fit to lovingly care for and raise them.
Now, keep in mind, this was done in a state that proudly proclaims that it protects the individual from unconstitutional intrusions from big government. Now, can you admit that this is somewhat ironic? I won't say funny because that drives you bonkers.
Yeah, totally bonkers. We can go with ironic for the time being, but definitely not funny.
Well, what's funny is when the people, when they go out voting for these candidates who proudly proclaim that they protect their freedoms and liberty, they won't see this as inconsistent with those proclamations. That's what's funny. Can you at least admit that?
It's not funny. Then on page 3, it states, to understand the vast breadth of section 15-28-11-D4, consider, for instance, a college freshman convicted of downloading prawn explicit photos of their high school partners that their high school partner sent to them. Now, under Alabama's law, that person will never be able to reside with their child, even if that college freshman does not become a parent until decades after graduating, even if that college freshman never engages in any other type of PFR type offenses.
And that's the problem with such legislation. Again, they could have done this had they done it wisely, but they don't try to do things wisely. Just do feel good things.
Then what specifically does the law prohibit a PFR from doing?
Well, residing with, as I understand it, an overnight stays, and they just an overnight visit, according to the court, occurs whenever an offender is in the same place as a minor for any part of the period between the hours of 10:30 and 6 a.m. According to the court, this section prevents Henry from being present in the same home of his son, one, at any time between the hours of 10:30 and 6 a.m., and two, for more than 4 hours a day on 3 consecutive days, three, for more than 4 hours a day on 10 or more days during calendar month. Now, that's pretty good. You got to give them credit. They did the consecutive and then they did the cumulative. And then fourth, yeah, on any other circumstance where he is habitually and systematically present at his son's home. Now, I don't know what habitually and systematically present would mean, but those are it sounds like they've pretty well battened down the hatch on any contact with your children.
Other than you'd need like a scientific calculator to figure out when you are in compliance or not. So I see that on page 13 that both parties filed for, hey, summary judgment, your favorite. I know how much you love that approach. And it states, on March 31st of 2023, the parties filed cross motions for summary judgment. The district court partially granted Henry's motion, and it denied the defendant's motion in full. The court concluded that section 15-20A11D4 implicated Henry's substantive due process rights to the care and custody and control of his child.
Well, you are correct. I generally do not prefer that approach, but it may have not been detrimental in this particular case. It looks like that this was narrow enough. The issue was more narrowly focused, and it may have not needed any expert witnesses, and it may have not I generally am very much against summary judgment.
Now, Alabama raised three arguments on appeal. First, it argued that section 15-20A-11D4 is constitutional as applied to Henry because individuals convicted of PFR type offenses do not have a fundamental right to reside with their child. Hang on, why would one group of people not have a right versus others?
Yes, I've caught that. But the funny thing is, 99% of the people will vote for the attorney general that his office put forward this argument. So the people of Alabama have no problem with this.
I see. All right. And then it asserts that even Henry does have such a right. The law survives strict scrutiny because it is narrowly tailored to advance Alabama's compelling interest in protecting the children. How did that go?
Not very well. The court stated, we reject Alabama's first claim and hold that section 15-20A-11-4, blah, 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 is unconstitutional as applied to Henry. The Constitution guarantees parents the right to live with their children. Now, remember, every one of those Alabamians put their hands on that Bible saying they will defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alabama. Henry did not necessarily forfeit that right when he committed a PFR type offense, yet section 15-20A automatically deprives him of that right.
And that's what we would call facially unconstitutional?
Well, facial means that there's no set of circumstances where it can be done. And as applied means that it might be constitutional, but it's not constitutional as you're applying it to me because of these factors.
And which way is that being done here? What were they trying to do?
Well, he was arguing both. And the court decided it was not facially unconstitutional. Because there would be a set of circumstances that I could conceive where you could do this constitutionally. And that's what I keep telling. Alabama, listen to this podcast. If you want to hire me, I will narrowly tailor a law for you that will survive judicial scrutiny. But it will be so narrowly tailored that very few people will be subject to it. And then the people that are subject to it will have a means for review. But you can do this if you want to do it constitutionally, if you will listen to me.
And then what about the second? The state argued that in section 15-20A-11-4D4, is facially constitutional because it covers at least some crimes for which the fact of a conviction is narrowly tailored to advance its compelling interest in protecting children, and because it covers at least some relatives who do not have the same fundamental right of cohabitation as do parents. Alabama contends that cases at the intersection of those two edges, namely step-siblings or step-parents who have raped or trafficked children, fall within the state's plainly legitimate sweep. How did that go for Alabama?
Well, that was where they got some traction, and I can see how they did. The court stated, as to Alabama's second argument, we agree that this section is not facially invalid, meaning there are circumstances where it could be constitutionally applied, at least at this posture. Henry has not shown that section 1528 is unconstitutional in all applications, which is what you have to show for a declaration of facial invalidity. For instance, as Alabama points out, step siblings and step parents may not have the same constitutional rights to cohabitation as do parents and children. The issue received limited briefing, so we conclude, at least for this appeal and without conclusively passing on the merits of that question, that Henry has not met the lofty burden of a facial challenge.
But what about the third argument then? Alabama asserts that at a minimum, the district court erred in entering a universal injunction that extends to plaintiffs other than Henry, who are not party to this lawsuit. How did that go?
Oh, the court stated, and finally, because we vacate the district court's injunction, we do not address Alabama's argument that the district court abused its discretion in entering a universal injunction. I misspoke. I thought they had not gotten an injunction. Apparently they did.
Can't trust you to do anything these days. Oh. So then on page 78, the court stated, put simply, as far as we can tell, in every other state, parents may present evidence that they are not a danger to their children. Section 15-20A-11D4's utter novelty highlights its constitutional infirmity. Indeed, the availability of judicial review in every other state suggests that measure has already proven effective in advancing the state's asserted interest. As a result, Alabama has not met its burden under strict scrutiny of rebutting Henry's proffered less restrictive alternative. This sounds to me as though the court has provided the state with a roadmap to clean up their mess.
They did indeed.
Do you think they will?
I believe they will modify the law in response to this. The question is, are they capable of enacting a constitutional law? I doubt it, but that remains to be seen.
Well, as we wrap this up, let me read the conclusion. We conclude that section 15-20A-11-4D4, I keep saying 11-4D, but it's 11-D4, violates Henry's fundamental right to live with his child as a parent, to care for and the custody of his child, because his conviction alone does not prove that he's a danger to his child. But we conclude the district court abused its discretion in facially enjoining section 15-20A-11D4 because Henry has not met his burden of showing that the law is unconstitutional in all its applications. For these reasons, we affirm in part and reverse in part the district court's grant of summary judgment to Henry, vacate the district court's injunction, and remand this case for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Well, what happens next?
Well, I'm assuming that Alabama's faced with two choices. They can file a cert petition or amend their law. That cert petition would be going to the United States Supreme Court. And I predict they will amend their law in the most minimal way possible.
Do you think that they will file a cert petition?
I fail to see what purpose that would serve.
Based on the 111 pages, and I couldn't even digest all of it, they cited so much case law and so much precedent, and they spent a great deal of time on this case. You see that it's been pending for all this time. And when a court has done such a fabulous job, it's hard for me to understand that they would believe that a cert petition would be useful to them other than a delaying tactic, because I don't see the Supreme Court granting cert, but if they did grant cert, I would see them likely affirming this.
So how about this, though? If nobody else in the U.S. is really, like, as we talk about which state is the worst for PFRs, between Florida, Alabama, and those guys around that area, like, they are pretty, pretty bad. Who toes this line, but a bit more sensibly? Go to number four.
Who toes the line a bit more sensibly?
Yeah, I mean, who applies, pushes the screws on PFRs with not quite so so much harshness?
Well, Washington State, I suppose, would be one. Minnesota would be another one. Colorado would be another one. And yeah, there are some states where Alabama could mimic, but they don't want to mimic those states. Those were run by the biggest collection of Looney Tunes and liberals that you could ever imagine.
And, those other states, not yeah, Alabama?
Yeah, well, that's the way they look at it.
Of course they do.
So.
Well, all right. Well, that's the end of that. So did you hear about the Department of Justice is terminating funds for PREA?
PREA, what's that?
PREA is the National Prison Rape Elimination Act. And I remember, Larry, when I first got locked up, that I was getting these pamphlets about PREA, that if I am being threatened with having my my virginity taken while I'm gone, that I could report it and there would be support services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So anywho, so the Department of Justice has terminated all funding for the National Prison Rape Elimination Act, or otherwise known as PREA, Resource Center. According to a letter from the National PREA Resource Center obtained by the appeal, oh my God, that's a liberal rag if I ever heard of one, among other activities, the group has previously trained prison sexual assault auditors, tracked the results of PREA investigations, and provided resources to imprisoned sexual abuse survivors. The cuts take effect when, but immediately. This can't be a good thing.
Well, I guess it would depend on how you look at good, but if you're in prison, I would say no, it's not. When asked for comment, a DOG spokesperson told the appeal in an email that discretionary funds that are no longer, those discretionary funds that are no longer aligned with it in, the administration's priorities are subject to review and reallocation. The administration's priorities are prosecuting criminals, getting illegal drugs off the streets, and protecting American institutions from toxic DEI and sanctuary city policies, end of quote.
Impact Justice operates the National PREA Resource Center through a cooperative agreement with the Department of Justice. The organization said in a statement that it is heartbroken about the administration's decision to cease funding. The Justice Department in 2012 adopted statutorily required regulations to guide facilities so they can live up to their responsibilities to protect people in their care. I was just about to ask you about this. And they set up a system of auditing to hold agencies accountable to the promise of PREA. Now, we've talked about this before, that if you are held in their custody and you don't have access to weapons to defend yourself or the ability to sequester yourself and lock yourself behind a door, shouldn't they be responsible for your safety?
That's been my position. If we take away a person's ability to defend themselves, we have to defend and protect them. That may cost money, folks, and it helps you decide how many people you want to incarcerate. But you're depriving them of their freedom as punishment. You're not depriving them of their life or of the sanctity of their sexual organs and their body. But I think that's Michaela. Is that how you pronounce that? Bowman?
I would say it's Michaela.
Michaela Bowman, Vice President, Senior Project Advisor, said, quote, defunding support for agencies that do work and the systems needed to operate the audit function suggests dismayingly that the DOJ abandoned its statutory responsibilities to protect the most vulnerable people in confinement from sexual abuse as required by PREA. Now, that sounds pretty strong, so it sounds like it's coming from a pointy head to me.
The article states, experts and advocates working to end prison sexual assault were uniformly aghast at the news. Corrine Kendrick, deputy director of the American Civil Liberties Union National Prison Project, told the Appeal in an email, "The actions by the Department of Justice to immediately zero out all funding for PREA investigations and audits will tragically make it more challenging to hold prison and jail officials responsible for the sexual assaults of people who they have locked up."
And the irony of this is that Congress unanimously passed the Prison Rape Elimination Act, known as PREA, in 2003. Now, unanimous, not like bipartisan, I mean, not like on a partisan party line vote. The legislation sought to provide for the analysis of the incidents and effects of prison rape in federal, state, and local institutions and provide information, resources, recommendation, and funding to protect individuals from rape. What a concept. We're going to cage you and we're going to try to protect you. It also created a commission to create standards for eliminating sexual violence in what kind of, what's that word?
Carceral.
I'm not even familiar with that word, settings. According to the center's website, the U.S. Bureau of Justice Assistance created the National PREA Resource Center in 2010 to provide federally funded training and technical assistance to states and localities and to serve as a single stop, a resource for research and tools for all those in the field to come into compliance with the federal standards. Now, see, the problem is we got them big old bad federal standards being imposed on our state and local jails, and we can't have that around here.
Clearly not. So then in a press release, Just Detention International, a nonprofit focused on ending sexual assault in prisons, said the cuts were devastating and would undoubtedly make carceral facilities more dangerous. Among other items, the nonprofit noted that the Resource Center helped teach imprisoned people about their rights, and how to report sexual assault. The center also partnered with local rape centers to help support imprisoned survivors.
And Linda McFarlane, Just Detention's executive director, said the shuttering of the National PREA Resource Center is quite simply catastrophic for incarcerated people. Now, remember, the administration that's in power was exceedingly popular with people incarcerated. Remember that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the irony, because I can't say funny. She went on to say its programs were a game changer for corrections agencies while also helping to shed light on the conditions inside prisons and jails across the country. Without the PREA Resource Center, corrections agencies will be left on their own when it comes to best practices to stop sexual abuse, and the public will be left in the dark about what goes on inside detention centers and facilities, which is where the public wants to be. But the worst outcome is that the closure means incarcerated children and adults will be decidedly less safe. Now, I don't know that I can say that's a true statement, but that's Linda McFarlane's position.
So you get some like very, very, very naive, immature, and like physically undeveloped 18-year-old that ends up in prison with somebody that's down for some really hard time stuff, and bad things are going to happen to that kid.
Well, in my very brief stops in county jails, I've been privy to observing not blatant rape, but coerced sexual activity that was not wanted, and there's nothing you can do about it. Was nothing you
there
can do
not,
about
it. There is not, because if you try and get involved, unless you're going to be the muscle, you can't even say anything.
So,
well, is there anything else that you want to cover? We're at about 47 minutes, and I will allow you to speak or cover another article if you would like.
I'm not prepared. I've been too lazy today. I actually had to do law firm work on Saturday. Can you believe that?
Oh, I can. That's pretty amazing. Well, I work 75 days a week, Larry. So you're not telling me anything I don't know. Well, we did get a new patron, as I mentioned earlier, this Jersey Determined, and I can say that name because I don't know who the guy is. I can make assumptions about where he lives, but that's about all I got, and I can't thank you enough for becoming a patron. Thank you so very much, and you also joined the Discord server, so look forward to seeing you here at some point. But otherwise, head over to registrymatters.co, where you can find the show notes and links everywhere that you need to go, and email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You know what? I forgot to pull out a voicemail message. I will get that, and we will cover that next week. Guy from New York who writes in every now and then. And then, as I said, support us over at patreon.com/registrymatters. We have a Discord server. We have some swag that is over at FYPEducation.com/shop. If you want to, we're going to have a table, I believe, at the NARSAL conference in Grand Rapids in another month or so, that you could come actually feel the quality and read all of the different t-shirts and sweatshirts and stuff that we're going to have there. Without anything else, Larry, I bid you adieu.
Well, I did notice while I was sitting here that half of the studio audience abandoned. So I guess whatever I said, it didn't go over very well.
I think it's just timing. People are probably still like food hungover from Easter.
So, all right. Well, I
hope everybody has a great weekend.
See you in a week. Good night.
Good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.